myself. I've also been very interested in organic agriculture and ecological agriculture, agroecology through my entire career as well. I think that I'm going to drag you through some of the same topics and in a way what I refer to personally as my midlife crisis. I am a soil scientist, and in a way I appreciate your questions about, you know, these differences in boxes, and it's sort of my big premise and sort of a background assumption is that we know a lot about how to manage agriculture sustainably, and I think people care very deeply, so that's a great benefit to people like me who have wonderful students coming who are interested in sustainable agriculture, and they see organic as a sort of a leader. And so my story today is in a way exploring this soil centrism, and I think that there's some things that if we trace the history of organic agriculture are very, very important to the history of science and really the way we conduct science. I think organic agriculture and I guess the story of Liebig, which was brought up, you know, these things come through all of the literature in the history of science. And we have a time of opportunity here, I think, but we have to question very seriously our scientific discourse. And I think that we're uncomfortable with the holism, and I think we have to go right at the values piece of this. So I'm just curious, how many people in the room are social scientists? Okay. You know, and I think we're in a really active time in sort of public science and the role of experts, and I think a lot of this change that we see in terms of pressures on resources, global awareness of really maybe the coming up of limits and the need to make some choices, I think we can learn quite a bit from this history. So I'll engage in this retelling. But I guess personally, you know, I'm a scientist and I'm interested in the theory and the history, but I've also been involved in farming. My husband is an organic farmer, and still routinely we go out there with horribly wet weather, which we know has been predicted and is consistent with climate change, you know, influenced very much by human actions, and look there at our cover crops in the spring, wanting to get a crop in so that he can actually satisfy those customers, you know, with the spader. And on him horribly guilt-ridden, so putting this all on his back and all on the soil for us to get the entire system right may be too much, right? So I think that we know a lot about rotations, and I think the farmers in the Midwest, a lot of farmers I've spent my whole career working with, know perfectly well how to improve their soil. I think we have issues with soil management and soil centrism that run across the scale. Organic-centered approach, and this caveat that soil is the foundation of sustainable management, not just in organic systems, but organic deserves, I think, credit for bringing this up. I also, you know, personally, I think this soil quality movement, so here I have this language from the IFOAM norms, which refer to the soil, but not to the soil for the soil's sake. I joke with my students and say that we grow plants just to animate the soil. You know, of course, I have an extreme bias, but we're looking at multifunctional agriculture. And yes, we would like to eat beautiful food, but we care for the earth and we care for conservation of all things, not just soil and water for ourselves, but for wild things. And so I think that the language pointing to multifunctional agriculture has been carried through in a very important way through organic standards language. This photograph was from the cover of the American Journal of Alternative Agriculture, which was an issue that was all about soil quality. But here, soil quality has always had a very controversial reception at these very meetings, and I think part of the reason that it's been viewed with some suspicion is because people see it as embodying and carrying along with it a worldview or a paradigm that is more holistic. And it's been uncomfortable for people because, in a sense, it's been seen for what it is, which is a challenge to a narrow use of soil just to grow high yields. And I think we want to deal directly with that in our scientific language and sort of carry along really the evolution of science as a useful tool to get agriculture right. So I think that organic is not alone. I just share with you this sort of soil centrism is a key concern, and we're lucky in the United States to have the Natural Resources Conservation Service. They passed in the 2007 Farm Bill a minimum standard of care for soils. And in that, they list multiple wants. I have a photograph on the left, which was out of the National Geographic, which I think is visually this paradigm of soil centrism and all that we ask. And this is a fantastic representation. I don't have a pointer, but you see in the front, you know, the American iconic farm family on the monolith of soil with the pantheon of soil biology in front. And this is all things great and wonderful, you know, to systems. So we've been somehow dropped into, parachuting into organic agriculture and soil centrism, somehow meant to engineer society and arrange it by the way we till the soil. And this really is something when we often shorthand it, and I think that, George, you did at the end where you say it's different, it has these other attributes, right? We imbue them. I think being a soil scientist, in some ways, I've put myself literally in a box and say, well, this is not for me to talk about. And I think, in a way, we're now seeing ourselves put on the spot quite literally. The NRCS has these different kinds of tools, this is a session on soils. It's in the sense of how do we get it right? We see lots of different approaches targeting different kinds of information supply, and I would encourage us to put some of our effort really towards getting the information into use that we have. And of course, we have some really exciting opportunities with new understandings that get at some of the nuanced biological mechanisms and how to manage this. But soil centrism is, and its connection to greater ecosystem services, is at the heart of lots of conservation tools. And so I ask you now, myself asking, why are we all so dirty-minded, right? Why is it that soil centrism has had this profound effect? And I've lost this one. And I have to admit, and this was sort of my midlife crisis, that soil centrism and this reason it comes up through all kinds of readings in history, not just agronomy, and this sort of reverence for soil that comes up in political speech, even today, I think we can trace back to soil reverence that comes from our conceptions of ourselves, the sort of early, you know, Adam was named after the soil, and this, you know, breath of God, and really, I think, a profound appreciation of what makes something living, you know, the conception of a soul and coming out of the earth. So we've had this connection, and I guess when science was really philosophy and quite religious, we were trying to gain our understandings, and there was a connection between our well-being and the earth. We appreciated soil and the darkness of the soil. We also had some concerns. So even Adam was created out of the dust. Some wonderful readings about how he was named after dirt to keep him humble. And so we have in the origin of this word for the being made out of soil, you know, feet out of clay, with this etymology with gom, with the same root term for humans, humility, hubris, and thankfully humor to keep us going. And this appreciation. So this, here I have a monolith here of a mollisol, which sometimes I jokingly say, you know, God's own soil, with, we really have this appreciation and the connection with dark soil, organic matter, humus, and agricultural well-being. We've also have this worry, and I think this dichotomous view of soil. Sometimes we think of them as dirty and something to exploit, and then sometimes we view them as very much ourselves. There's some wonderful reading about the Old Testament, really, and this naming of Adam after dirt as a stewardship doctrine and a warning. And we have different interesting discourse about whether we are stewards or despots that I think comes through this idea of a golem, of something that really could actually have insufficient responsibility to the resource. I think if you trace these metaphysical and religious origins where soil centrism shows up, as we gain our understanding, we go right to Aristotle and this division of organic and inorganic chemistry, where we have organic things having this life force, this phlogiston, that ends up being at the center of the debate about the humus theory, because we really don't know how things decompose. So this wonderful argument, not only about nutrient uptake, but really about this sort of tension in philosophy. So we go and work through into what I think was very much in the Middle Ages, this natural philosophy, which was a very conservative view, which it had. I have this wonderful graphic here that's very alchemical. We have a geocentric Earth with human care, and people are beginning to understand chemistry and trying to really decipher plant-soil relations, but very much have this connection between our actions and our stewardship and the well-being of the garden. So I have a picture then on the right there of the bestiaries, which were these warnings about humans, which had intellect, but we also have this bestial nature. And so we see very much in this science and in poetry and writings about agriculture, this fear about over-exploitation of resources. And so I think that view of the soil as ourselves and that mistrust of ourselves as stewards is very old and something that was very deeply ingrained. And when we had basically the overturn of natural philosophy in this tracing through the 17th century, and here I have Justice von Liebig on the stamp, who really championed in what we have as a very dominant paradigm, a heroic paradigm. And I dropped off a paper because I culled a bunch of slides, as I can see this sort of a mania for me to realize that my own sort of assumptions about soils have other origins besides just organic chemistry. Liebig and the heroic traditions of agriculture, which really come out of the methodologies that basically win out at this time because they're quantitative, they're reductionist, they can provide direct evidence. They're also, and this is a very, I think, important literature, but not the domain necessarily of agronomists, but important for us to understand that part of it's influencing our comfort in this discourse. This capture and compatibility of the methodologies that Liebig uses with production agriculture and this sort of very good writings about how they've really empowered some, lead to, you know, corporate commoditized agriculture, is rejected very much by some people in the literature who aren't necessarily soil scientists. So this different structuring of agriculture pointed to by Michael Pollan is blamed directly on Liebig's methodology and even the way we've organized science training in schools. You know, so there's a very rich literature on the history of science that is all about agriculture, and Liebig gets quite a bit hung around his neck. Then I have on the right here this image, and this is from Fukuoka, where this immediate rejection of reductionism of Liebig, and I think some unfair selective readings of Liebig, because Liebig was also a holist and appreciated very much what a healthy soil imbued with good rotation had and understood, and he himself wrote about what I think a lot of people, especially in European tradition, talk about physical fertility of soils, not just chemical fertility. But you see here this, you know, staves in the barrel where he, although he wasn't the first to articulate the laws of the minimum, that the most limiting nutrient would limit production, and then you have this diagram that, and he's accused of forgetting that barrel rests on a landscape that all these other limits about production could compromise productivity. So I think historically, there are many soil-centric traditions, not just organic, and some of them that we don't often talk about and we don't touch very much well-respected scientific venues are those that are explicitly spiritual. So we have here modern science, which we're no longer even, I don't think, appreciate that we're supposed to be philosophers thinking about how things should be done well. That dialogue, certainly in the agronomic tradition, goes away. And we have this reaction. So we have Rudolf Steiner, where they talk about the spiritual foundations of renewable agriculture, and Fukuoka with this diagram, very geocentric, very much connected to this natural philosophy view, which has, and it's not just about consumers and consuming things. So I think your point, I think this view and this reaction that's been carried forward by what we call alternative ag movements is very much this view of humans as important tenders of the land in a position of responsibility. But they get into some really interesting ideas about production and the productive ways to tend and connecting them to well-being in life that are just very important reading, and in a way I think we're coming back to some of these concepts and critiques now with more interdisciplinary explorations, I think, of what we want from agriculture, you know, in addition to or beyond just high yields. This modeling of nature, an explicit hypothesis, which was very much a part of natural philosophy. You know, we took because we were sort of respectful that God would have this grand and perfect design, and we had this, and there is in the literature discussions of religious, of spiritual chemistry, even from the 17th century, that are picked up very directly in what we say natural systems agriculture movement, I think by Wes Jackson and by the perennial or permaculture movements. And this is a mandala with the earth in the center here from permaculture. So we see, I think, this some of the reasons that many people are attracted to soil science, thankfully, from my perspective, and see it as, in a way, the foundation of sustainable agriculture, I think goes back to, in a sense, these shorthanded assumptions that are fairly philosophical or metaphysical, in essence, and this trust of nature. I think here I have the articulation with the organic movement that I think has become more comfortable for scientists in a way, because I think some of the early champions of it were very scientific-minded, and I often credit this quote with Lady Eve of reclaiming the humus theory or restating it in a way, and I think we're living in exciting times where people are understanding mechanistically and revisiting ideas about plant-soil relations, the role of biology. So here she says, humus benefits the soil in three ways, mechanically, as a plant food, and fundamentally by modifying soil biology or binomics. So this is really the tenets, if you went through the sort of I would say undercover soil-centric movement and through soil quality, those were the three planks, right, of what we wanted to manage in soils. It was the physical, chemical, and biological, and that was received with much suspicion because in addition to caring for those, you know, multiple properties, we wanted multiple services, and I think we've come through that now. Although I was amazed in this society, in the science policy briefs, I think this was 2 years ago, where they were even doubting whether the word agroecology was legitimate. And I think that we're really, I look at the history of, and credit the organic movement and these other alternative ag movements and ecology as really moving along and keeping holistic science alive, if you will. And they really have this, other approaches to science that have now, I think, very very fruitful combination with some of our agronomic methods that can and will benefit all agricultures. I think organic agriculture, by asking itself to keep track of multiple services, can help very much. But tracing through these different traditions in agroecology, different views about whether we can aspire to manage the larger system, and whether our natures are good with regard to stewardship are very different. So I think we see lingering and very much alive in the perspectives of people, whether their first view of a new technology, for example, BT or GMs, is optimistic and they say, wow, this rocks, I could do so much with it, or whether they are from more of the ecological tradition where they are suspicious of our motives and think we're going to be bad stewards, I think is something that's important to just acknowledge on the face of it. So here I have this bestiary here in how we view ourselves and think about that as we move through this. And I think that now with, I think we're in another phase of the structure of scientific thought. I think we are experiencing a scientific revolution, in part driven by communication tools, and also maybe a breaking through of people appreciating that we can't have everything all at once. I think some of economic pressures on us, a variety of things, and this is, you know, not coming from me. I have enjoyed reading outside my own soils literature to really look at this reunification of thought. You know, I think as a result of the modern scientific tools and modern sort of approaches to science, we had what people recognize as two cultures, where you could be in art and philosophy, or you could do real science. And I think that, that real scientists became very uncomfortable even acknowledging or dealing with wants, goals, and, so, and what we sort of normative values. So organic agriculture had articulated it very clearly, these broad set of normative goals, that it wants healthy food, healthy society, equity, and I would still submit to you that that's maybe too much to ask from a well-designed rotation, right? But I think now we have people saying that we have this third culture by interchange, and I think that the dialogue that we see traced through the organic standards and other standards following on the coattails are part of this and will be told and recounted in the history of science in the same way that Liebig's contributions have been. So this is my diagram modifying. You know, we have this positivist conception of science as a way to truth. And it can directly deliver to you truth, in fact, because it can actually falsify the results. So it's concrete, and we can have these experiments that are yes, no. And we won't deal with all this fuzzy, squishy stuff like what is good, right? But now we're back to a place where we all think agree that we must actually get that on the table, and we might have some hard choices in front of us and disagree. So, you know, this history of science that I'm tracing here, I was myself following this soil centrism, even to the point to really enjoy this naming of this golem science, this science that has basically turned against its master and become unuseful. And I think that this accusation or critique of science is interesting in many ways, in part because the discourse is unintelligible to practitioners and too theoretical. And this demand that science come back to the utility of people making decisions. And I personally, as a person who's worked in sustainable agriculture and participatory research and had to actually go on the firing line with farmers who would like something practical out of my mouth, appreciate this, right? So I think that this sort of experience that many people have had, and especially through soil quality work, puts us on the spot. So my challenge to you, and I didn't bring my watch up here, how many more minutes do I have so I know how fast I have to talk?
You're still okay. In a minute, I'll figure this out.
Okay. Right. So sort of this is halftime, right? Halftime, you know, this sort of, I'm done philosophizing and dragging you back through this history because, you know, and I've already confessed to you, I think the soil and our ideas about soil stewardship are very important. I think that we know a lot. I know a lot of you in the room know a lot and have tons to offer. And we do still see really hyper-exploitation of fabulous soils in the Midwest, right? We really do, and we know that we can't do that forever. But we have, in a way, in North America, an embarrassment of riches, right? But if we look more globally and we think long-term, and I think that right now we have a very obvious renewal of the discussion of the Green Revolution, which I think that we need to engage in rather than just go into our offices and grouse, or, you know, I think that there's very important questions to be answered and a lot of information that can be brought to bear. And so with soils information about good management and the assignment that was given to a stewardship or stewardship-centric view where, yes, the rotations that you use and the footprint of the farm. So this is our farm on the sort of first year when we started in Illinois. And when we tried to get land to grow horticultural crops, we were told directly that you'll never be able to buy land because we're landlocked in Illinois by, you know, row crop agriculture. We had a very hard time. But you see here that this view of farms and farm systems and scaling, and now as we trace what organic agriculture is doing. Organic agriculture is going to be challenged because it's put itself up as a leader, as a better way, right? This assertion of betterness, of greater, really I'm going to use the word virtue, is really uncomfortable and offensive to some people. So it's going to get shot at. And so articulating this clearly, I think, is something that will help us improve agriculture. So from the soils piece, I've been watching this and enjoying this literature, which is this critique of the standards that have come through many readers where they said basically this failure to include the social wants, which you listed directly, is in direct violation of organic principles. And so, and similarly, the production on what you cannot apply or on these little techniques made organic agriculture very palatable to this neoliberal corporate agriculture. And it's seen as a bad thing. Other readings in this paper by Gibbon I really very much enjoyed, where it was really much more optimistic. So again, this tradition of readings of superstitious or pessimistic and untrusting or optimistic about the way we're going, and saying that really this, looking at the history of the way the standards have worked in Europe, has allowed this expansion, and they have really resulted in making it more tractable for more people to enter, and then passing on responsibility to individuals to be managers of their own domains, if you will. So by really allowing individual actors in the standards to track their own practices, record them, and in a way embed the precautionary principle. So you'd be proactive about preventing erosion, for example, and thinking actively in the, you know, advance of how you would do protective measures was a more effective way than, in a way, think of a highly engineered approach that would be very, very regulated and prescribed. This is a very nice paper. I encourage, if you're interested in this, to read it. But his reading of sort of how the standards have worked in Europe, and very much influenced by the Soil Association and I think pre-existing certification labels, having a great deal of ownership, and in a way seeing these larger standards do away with civil societies, which has also been a critique of the standards, you know, and I think offended a lot of longtime practitioners. But the original standards were very crop and soil focused, and I think they were seen as weak because they had this input substitution approach, or that has been seen to allow that. They, over time, expanded to include livestock systems and nutrient cycling, calling for sort of nutrient budgeting. And then over time, as we've added more kinds of organic industry, actually scaled up. Contrary to Michael Pollan's assertion, actually we see organic thinking going up to production systems, and I think with some very real concessions made so that that industry could adapt over time. We see this effort and calls for clear and credible criteria. And so I want to come back to this with clear and credible criteria. If we're going to, you know, ratify or fail organic agriculture based on soil performance and soil functionality, is that what we aim to do? We've seen, and he traced this attempt to scale vertically down where you would prescribe, for example, something like rotation length or animal husbandry, and it's been very aggressively rejected, allowing for more flexibility and localized nuance for application of standards to different kinds of practitioner in different locations. So, and I think of that personally, this site-specific nature to agriculture. In our own definition of sustainable agriculture, we have sort of a very strong appreciation of the local edaphic factors being very important determinants. And so I would say that this tracing of the history would be positive, allowing individuals to make decisions if we trusted them or if we trusted ourselves. We see on these sort of coattails, and I think resonating with this demand for clear and credible evidence, right? This is sort of weight of evidence or proof being echoed in these calls for sustainability standards and for accounting systems. Right now, this in the United States, the ANSI standards to create their own sustainability standards created quite a negative reaction from, I think, some folks in the organic community, some folks in USDA who thought a lot about this, in part. And sort of, and this is more for people who are social scientists about how we shape the way things that we want to do. Myself, as a jealous soil scientist, looking for the, you know, whether soils gets in the mix here, is something that I'm doing. And I've been interested to really see that the approach in the sustainability standards is not unlike the language that we're seeing in the organic standards, but the methodologies that they're looking to down the road, I think they'll be more likely to use life cycle analysis and sort of interest in things that are quantitative. So you could pass and fail that would be very comfortable for industry, because these industry standards really are very much connected to product and facilitating sales. So, you know, looking at services we see showing up in the language and approaches to management through farming systems. And in the ecosystem management, something I think that is really good in terms of our soils information is not decoupling the whole system to just score or fail an individual field. A lot of our data on organic agriculture from replicated trials is from a plot, not managed like a whole entire farm. And I think that sometimes if we extend, say, NRCS tools to plot-based assessment of organic farming, it doesn't reward them for landscape kind of design that is I think, often present. And we see this in the language with the sustainability standards, too, taking a landscape view. This discomfort with monetizing ecosystem services, which is a critique that is in out there of what people call green neo-capitalism, and I think the organic movement, I'm not sure whether they will or will not be comfortable with that kind of monetization. You know, branding and selling something, services and added value in a brand, is that the same or different than putting a price on, for example, something like soil carbon? But this is a parallel and I think influential sidebar to the organic movement, and is helpful if we trust ourselves to highly engineer and quantify services, and may be seen as unhelpful if we view ourselves, you know, and we're worried about people gaming the system. The approach taken in, say, natural resource conservation services, the organic standards, and I think also in a lot of the approaches to, for example, provide green payments, is to follow the practices and really to look at the practices that farmers use and then try to score them in terms of their performance. And so we have these drivers of ecosystem performance and soil well-being and these kinds of matrices that we would see. But I think that whether you in the audience or me as a soil scientist really think that we are going to go out and, for example, measure fungal biomass, ratios of bacteria to fungi, and be able to say that this is good or this is bad, whether that's, we really think we're going to go that far is a very important question. Right now, the demand or request that we measure soil organic carbon trends over time and score or fail them, I really seriously ask you that when we see that there are a lot of feedbacks, and we may, this is my own personal opinion, have to work very hard with very best management practices with rotation to hold our own against falling carbon levels as we have in many environments where we have increasing temperatures and increasing moisture, right? Best management practices may still be a worst case scenario, right? So scoring and failing, let alone even just the challenge of getting a good, something as simple as total organic carbon, you know, sequestration measures are a little bit difficult to do and very expensive, right? So this practice-based approach and rewarding people for what they're trying to do rather than what they're achieving is common right now in a lot of these approaches to stewardship that are soil-centric. So we share the territory. We have a common view of multifunctional performance. And through all of those alternative soil, alternative ag movements, and now I think a sort of a darling of sort of a gearbox is soil organic carbon as the proxy for ecosystem services. So it's the most likely thing that we will succeed or fail in, and it is, people are attempting to monetize it very directly. And I think for organic agriculture, this different approach, right? Right now organic agriculture has standards that prescribe goals and encourage, do we want to get more prescriptive in how those practices work? Will somebody be a multi-dipper? Will they get rewarded for soil carbon sequestration with a carbon sequestration contract? Will they also engage with NRCS? You know, and so the soils information is then going to be supplied to different users, right? The conservation stewardship program right now is a possible and important opportunity. I think that the people have, in the organic movement, have pursued very aggressively equal opportunity with NRCS. This is voluntary at this point, just like organic certification would be, and people are rewarded by taking on additional conservation activities and improving and maintaining existing practices at a well. So this should be very easy entry for organic. The NRCS tools, really, I think we deserve, or I think the soil quality efforts, which really tried to develop pedotransfer functions for multifunctional performance of soil condition, if people go to a soil testing approach, this would be something that, I think the view was compatible with monitoring and quantifying performance of, soil properties in specific fields and looking whether they were improving or degrading, and then by using modeling or extrapolation, connecting them to services, right? So if we go to a soil testing, you know, prove it or lose it, I think this is where we'll look at these indicators and properties. Although I'd say, and I have on the bottom here to remind me, this desire to scale up and look at services in a farm view is something that NRCS is also developing tools as well that look not only at, properties in a field, but the proportion of your land under permanent cover, which I think we would all agree practically is a, probably a good thing to consider as well. So, right, this assignment, our job. How many of you are soil scientists? Okay, my people. You know, our job is to get our toys out of the box and, help people do what we know is needed to be done in terms of conserving soil and water resources for the agriculture we want. So we've got lots of great work and knowledge that could come across for soil tests that we would put in the hands of individuals, but those could also be pass-fail metrics with a direct quantifiable test. People like, you know, we like numbers in that way. Mm-hmm. Recommendations for best management practices. I think right now we see with NRCS opportunities, including organic under their umbrella, some good thinking there. But again, this, how will those be developed? How will they be embedded inside particular organic production systems, right? All organic is not monolithic. I think I'm going to run out of time with some of my slides. You know, I work at my own farm. We have organic vegetable production in a place where we don't have integrated livestock. We also have excessively ridiculous PR promoting manure as a godsend. And manure can be a pollutant just as much as soluble fertilizer can be. Without good soil tests, but not just tests with upper bounds for yield, but tests for limits for environmental degradation, we're in trouble. We have a lot of good thinking where we could really modify the interpretation frameworks for some of our tests and best management to get conservative boundaries around them. And this thinking, I think, has NRCS has done some of this. I think in terms of our weight of evidence, and I've already alluded to this a little bit, you know, if we emphasize good works and connect to soil organic carbon, one of our jobs as soil scientists might be to make sure that alternative practices like organic get their equal showing, right? So we did, this is just some of my work, but many of you in the room have done similar work where if we go to comparative plot kinds of studies, we can see that organic matter levels are equal to or often exceed conventional practices where they're tilling. In this particular study, the amount of increase, if I did rates of sequestration, they would be equal to the rates that people are awarding for no-till. And this, with my student Emily, was from long-term studies comparing conventional and organic agriculture with and without manure. So we also have this paradigm in organic that says that in order to increase organic matter, and I think these are valid questions, is it you're just adding carbon with manure, or are you actually building it through the plant contributions? And this is a yes and no. Some systems work and some don't. So we can generate data to advocate for organic, but more importantly, we should generate data and tools to help organic and all the other agricultures succeed in meeting these goals. 1 minute or okay. So this is an example just of a comparison of similar kinds of rotations. This was at the Walco site for a multi-site study of, comparison of organic and conventional. And this is where really I think taking some of our metrics for, on-farm solutions, we didn't have significant increases in organic matter and they had crop yields consistently doing poorly under the legume-based system. And I think by using some of our soil measures, we really want to be better architects to improve management and nutrient balance, right? This sort of what might feel to some people fuzzy conception of what is optimal. I think we have ideas and indicators that could tell us when we have an excess of free nitrogen. Same idea that we saw here, these measures, and sorry, I don't have a pointer, but we have amino acid N and total hydrolyzable nitrogen. We just have off the chart, very high levels of nitrogen, and then very low levels of what we look at as an indicator of particulate organic carbon, where we know we're pouring on lots of residues in the, particularly the legume-based system, but we're just accelerating decay. And this is one example from one site where they've stopped this experiment because the organic systems were doing very poorly, and it's a soil-specific effect. So here's a closing point of, you know, a monolithic approach to just championing organic is good isn't going to get agriculture right on the specific farms, right? There's one suite of pieces of information we need to help people optimize their goals if we trust them. There are a bunch of other tools, and I'll, you know, NRCS has tools, we have budgeting tools, but this was a comparison of NRCS tools that run models for the rotation, and you have tools that were for the plot here for the soil conditioning index, and then a newer tool they'd been working on that was a little more holistic. And you see in the red that they would have flunked, and this is from an experiment we did comparing organic types of organic. The tools would have generically flunked those rotations. So they're practice-based, not soil-specific. And when we directly measured organic carbon in this particular site and experiment, we did just fine. We actually increased under production. And we were surprised we increased under vegetable, intensive vegetable production, just like we did under pasture systems, right? So soils don't lie, and we have a lot of work to do both to improve policy metrics or enrollment conservation tools and help farmers optimize their systems, but it's going to be very soil specific. And so I myself am encouraged that the standards, in a sense, are, I think, focusing more up in agriculture and values-based, but I think quantitative metrics and specific technical tools are going to be needed, and whether they end up helping or hurting, so you're at ease, right? Depends upon, in a sense, our view of ourselves and our ability to, you know, not allow them to be exploited for profit purposes.
Thanks, Michelle. Thank you very much.